The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of December 10th, 2018. On this week's show, we'll discuss Oklahoma's Heisman-winning quarterback, Kyler Murray, and the choice he'll soon be making about whether to pursue a career in football, baseball, or both. We'll also be talking about Jimmy Butler, Joel Embiid, the Philadelphia 76ers, floor spacing, locker room toxicity, and how to build a winning team in the modern NBA. And finally, the NFL has put a call out for proposals on how to, quote, modernize punting. And I'm happy to report that we are here to help. Joining me in our Washington, D.C. studio is a man who's always helpful when the help that's being requested pertains to kicking a football. It's Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Hey, Josh.
And with us for the whole show today is Gene Demby of NPR's Code Switch blog and podcast, sometimes Pop Culture Happy Hour, Reply All, other fine things you can read and listen to. Welcome, Gene.
What's good? Thanks for having me.
Of course. Before we get to the show proper, I want to give another enticement for people to give us a call for our year-end call-in show. It's 77-HANG-UP-10, and you should call us a high-quality phone line. I assume that all of our listeners, Stefan, are in possession of only the highest quality telephone equipment.
Oh, they better be. I mean, it's kind of a requirement to listen to the show, isn't it?
If they want to talk to us.
Yeah.
So conundrums are good. Advice for children, for all the kids out there.
The lovelorn.
Anything is viable. The phone number is 77-HANG-UP-10. We want to hear from all of you guys. And the show is going to be, so we haven't decided if it's going to be the Christmas show or the New Year's show, but get your calls in like the next week or so.
Dear Josh will be the new segment.
For the advice show. For the lovelorn. I like it.
The sports lovelorn.
Yeah. let's encourage matters of the heart, sports or otherwise.
Get those twincest calls in.
On that note, on Saturday night in New York, Oklahoma quarterback Kyler Murray became the second straight Oklahoma quarterback after Baker Mayfield to win the Heisman, beating out the season-long favorite Alabama's Tua Tagovailoa, as well as Ohio State quarterback Dwayne Haskins. They invited him there. He got a free trip to New York, even though there wasn't really a shot of him winning the gold. Murray threw for more than 4,000 yards, 40 touchdowns, in his first season as a starter after transferring from Texas A&M. He also plays baseball, and Oklahoma's Heisman campaign for him was a redux of the old Bo Jackson, Bo Knows Nike ad. Gene, that's like the most iconic ad campaign for sports fans of our age. The shoulder pads, holding the baseball bat behind his neck. With Oklahoma getting ready to play Alabama in the college football playoff, he's probably only going to have one more game this season. We don't want to put a limit on this guy's ceiling except to say that he's not going to beat Alabama. but he has to decide whether his football career is over or he's going to try to make it to the NFL or he's going to try to play both. Like in his interviews in the last couple weeks, he's been a little cagey. He said, maybe I haven't decided yet. I need to talk to my family. His agent, Scott Boras, says this decision has already been made and he is going to play baseball. It makes sense that Scott Boras would say that because he's the baseball agent. Do you have the sense, Gene, from listening to Murray, that this is actually still an open question, or is the guy just going to play baseball?
I mean, it seems like that is on the table in a real way. I mean, and the more you think about it, there are like a bunch of real benefits to Scott Boras will be pissed off, but like for him going to the NFL, right? Like it seems like his
con. Scott Boras would be pissed off.
which would probably not be a small thing. Okay, so he's a small guy, right? He's 5'10", 190-ish or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, he wouldn't be the biggest NFL quarterback, right?
No.
But, you know, you have this recent history of successful, small, mobile quarterbacks. Russell Wilson's a little bit beefier than him. Russell Wilson, Baker Mayfield's not that big.
Right.
Like, his star potential in the NFL is probably higher. His career also could be much shorter in the NFL, too. I don't know. Like it seems like if you were, I don't know. It's like you'd have to understand like what's happening in his mind because he could be have a long career in the majors and be basically anonymous, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, even if he was an all-star in the majors, right, at this point, you could be basically anonymous.
Absolutely.
But right. He could be a backup quarterback in the NFL and have some notoriety, stick around for a while. I mean, but he could be a star in the NFL. Yeah. I don't think it's on the table for him.
Right. And I think that it's funny that when you think this conversation ends up being baseball, now ends up being baseball safer. Don't get hit.
Right.
Save your brain. A little more chill. The perception is you don't have to work as hard.
Guaranteed contracts. Mm-hmm.
Guaranteed contracts. But all of that is conditioned on the fact that you've got to make the major leagues. And that is not an easy thing. There is no minor league football to apprentice in and work your way up and get better to earn your spot. You go straight to the majors in football. So it's not clear how. I mean, he's projected. I mean, he was drafted, what, ninth in the baseball draft in the first round? And that's really good. That is a sign that this dude can ball and he has a chance to be a starting outfielder. They're projecting him as a center fielder in the majors. He's super fast. He can hit, not for much power at this point, but that can change over the course of a guy's career. But he's still probably going to have to play 3 or 4 years in the minors. That is still 3 or 4 years of potential injury, and that is still 3 or 4 years where basically what you are making is your bonus. And his bonus was not insubstantial.
$4.6 million.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Ninth slot in the major league draft is a good chunk of money.
So I was watching an interview that Tim Tebow did with Murray, and this was actually, I think, before we settled on doing this as a topic, so I have only myself to blame for watching this video. And yet, the man who I have come to refer to as Edward R. Tebow asked a very, I thought, profound, it wasn't that the question was profound, but I thought the answer was actually profound. Let's listen to this exchange between Tebow and Kyler Murray.
Me and you both love more than one sport.
Yeah.
Which one do you love more? Football, baseball.
Which one do you love more?
If I had to say one night in one game, I would pick a football game. But see, the thing in baseball is you get 162 of them.
Yeah, I know.
I get more nights to go compete and love what I do.
Yeah.
So Tebow now plays baseball, as I think most people know. After
plays, yes.
After his brief and ignominious NFL career, but I thought that breakdown was exactly right.
I think
playing football and Stefan, you also I think hit on something with the safer thing. Like if I were him, I would choose football even with the danger. Because, and as they went on to talk about in this interview, baseball is a game of failure. Kyler Murray is not actually that good at baseball yet, and it's going to take years for him even to get to the major league level. He's drafted high on potential. And just the idea of playing baseball for like years and years in the minors, maybe not ever getting that good at it. Like there's a reasonable chance he wouldn't ever become a major league quality player or a star player. Whereas in football, as a quarterback, the risk is a little less. He's an amazing electric talent in football. He plays with a kind of joy and he brings joy to a huge amount of people who watch him play. For me, that would be really, really hard to pass up.
I mean, and he would probably start for a bad team. I mean, like he's projected to be like a fringe first rounder, right, in the NFL draft.
Well, I think his stock has gone up a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think he was sort of a second round lock, and now it's low first round.
That's going to have a huge effect on the decision. Baseball America, Stefan, you sent this around, did an analysis, and it said if he was like Lamar Jackson and drafted at the tail end of the first round, the guaranteed money he would get from a signing bonus would be bigger than the guaranteed $4.6 million he got from baseball. But he's as you said, Gene, he's a really small guy. Russell Wilson and Drew Brees and Baker Mayfield, I don't know if there's a legit difference, but they look bigger than Kyler Murray. Like Kyler Murray looks really small.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be a barrier for him. Like he looks like Doug Flutie.
Right.
And there's a big difference. Like if it only takes one team, maybe a team will take him in the first round. But what if he drops to the third or fourth round? Like, would that actually make the difference between whether it'd be a good decision or not?
Well, it definitely makes a difference financially, and he's going to be hearing not only from Boris but from, you know, his family members. And the financial consideration in baseball is not insubstantial. I mean, yeah, $4.6 million is a lot, but it's $4.6 million because let's project that he has some time before he is major league level. Say 3 years, that's reasonable. And let's say he is a successful major leaguer. Unless he is an off-the-charts rookie second-year player, he's not going to sniff the big money until he hits free agency or, you know, or arbitration level. Mm-hmm. So he's looking at, you know, 4 to 9 years before he gets paid the way he would get paid under a rookie deal in the NFL, right, forgetting what his second contract in the NFL might look like in 2024 or 2025.
And even though he's a small guy, it's like it's not
early. Sorry, 2024. No, that's way too long, right? 2019. How long is the rookie deal in the NFL? 4 or 3 years?
Three or four.
I think, depending on where you're drafted.
Right.
I mean, and he's a small guy, but it's not like they're drafting him to be, you know, Ryan Mallett. Like, he's not going to be this, like, pocket pass, like, sitting back there, like, who's not mobile. Like, he'll – I think because there's so many college-style offenses in the league now, in the NFL, there will be a lot of teams that will find him really intriguing, I think. I don't know. I feel like he'll probably start a handful of NFL games in the next 2 years if he goes to the NFL.
Right. And Boris is going to try to obfuscate this too. He already has financially. I mean, he was quoted as saying, how many quarterbacks in the NFL make $100 million? If a center fielder can steal 60 bases and hit 20 home runs consistently, his earning potential will exceed what most quarterbacks make. Well, yeah, but you got to steal 60 bases and hit 20 home runs. And how many guys do that?
Well, as you were getting to the baseball, the economic system in baseball pushes guys to free agency when they're like 29 or 30 years old, and speed doesn't play as well when you're that age. And if his game is entirely predicated on that or largely predicated on that, then that's an even bigger risk that he's taking. I think we can overstate the importance of coaches in all sports, but Lincoln Riley, the Oklahoma coach, is now had two consecutive quarterbacks win the Heisman. Baker Mayfield was a walk-on at the start of his career. He obviously has a lot of talent, but he's not a guy who was pegged as a Heisman winner out of high school, certainly. Kyler Murray, as we've said, is not a traditional mold of a quarterback. And it's worth saying that Riley has been talked about as a guy who the NFL would be interested in now. And Gene, you mentioned like more college-style offenses, a broader acceptance in the NFL of whether it's, you know, guys like Lamar Jackson getting the chance to start, or even some, you know, what the Eagles have done with Wentz. With their offense. It's not like out of the question that in a couple years Riley could be in the league, and that the kind of offense that he runs at Oklahoma wouldn't be abnormal in the NFL. And also with like the rules around protecting quarterbacks, I mean, it feels to me like it's even hard to conjure a reasonable argument for him to play baseball. And that's like been the conversation has been like, obviously he has to play
and
baseball.
I know I just pissed on the idea that, you know, he could make big money quick in baseball. On the other hand, he's hearing what people are saying about him too. I mean, I found in like 5 minutes of Googling baseball people comparing him to Ricky Henderson and Mike Trout.
Okay, let's calm down.
I know. Keith Law, who's a reasonable guy and very smart and worked in a front office, works for ESPN now, you know, he described him as a plus-plus runner who really took the center field after playing shortstop in high school, has a good simple swing, hard contact, doesn't have much power now, struck out a lot, but he is projecting him as sort of might end up a major league all-star center fielder.
But wait, I think we need to back up for a second and just explain to people how, like, raw he is as a baseball player. Like in 2017 with Oklahoma in college, with the aluminum bats and like batting averages in college baseball are like very high.
Yes.
He had 122.
Oof.
Last year he hit 276, which is a huge improvement. But this guy is like needs a lot of reps.
Right. And we also haven't touched on
he could be Mike Trout or he could be, you know, bad.
Right. He did both at Oklahoma, which is impressive. I mean, he played in on one day he played in Oklahoma's spring game and then drove to the baseball field and started in center field for a Sooners game against Texas.
That is amazing.
So he, you know, we haven't even addressed the fact, like, could this guy do both? Or could he try one and do the other? And that is more likely. I think the pattern that we tend to see with athletes like him is that, all right, let me do baseball. I got a spot. I can play, see how good I can get. And then if I suck, I'm Chad Hutchinson, and I decide, you know, Scott Boras, hey, negotiate me an NFL contract, which is exactly what happened with Chad Hutchinson.
But wait, it's way more boring to talk about him doing one and then trying the other. Let's talk about the potential logistics of doing both. Like, you're iconic if you can do both, like Bo Jackson, Deion Sanders.
And those guys were also, like, freak athletes.
Right.
Like, Bo Jackson is like a Paul Bunyan figure, right? I mean, he's not that, right?
Kyler is not that?
Kyler's not that.
Well, with Deion, you also had the legendary day where he took the helicopter between the...
Yes, that's right.
Like,
I want to see more of that.
And yeah. we already mentioned the poster, playing baseball and football together. If this guy wants to maximize his fame and potential as an endorser and just become this figure that we'd be talking about decades later, like, that's what you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like the forces of pro sports are, like, conspiring against this more than they were in the 80s. I don't know. Is that because, like, there's just more teams expect to have more control over guys now, and it's just the demands are higher?
You would think it would be easy. I mean, like you said, the infrastructure is there now. I mean, it would be easier to get back and forth, right? I mean, what Deion was playing for, who was he playing for when he made that?
The Yankees.
And the Falcons? Was it the...
He was playing for the Falcons and the Braves simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And when
right.
he, I believe the helicopter episode was when the Braves were in the playoffs and the Falcons had a game that day. And so there was only, I think, a brief period when he was actively doing both rather than, like, going, you know, finishing out the season and then moving over to another
right.
one.
It's weird. I mean, like, I'm thinking about this now. Like, Deion should have just sat out the Falcons game. I mean, it's like early in the season, right? If it's the baseball playoffs, it's early in the NFL season. Just, like, come in week four or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, shoulda. He wanted he wanted to be a legend.
That's bananas, yeah.
But what I was hearing in Kyler Murray's sort of waffling last week was that he's, you know, he wants to do both, or he's just a 22-year-old who can't decide.
Like, or when he made this decision, he hadn't won the Heisman Trophy.
He hadn't won the Heisman Trophy. So he's got Boras leaning on him. Murray's also got his family background to contend with here. His uncle Calvin was a baseball player, played in the majors, had a long career, I think, and was hired by Scott Boras, works for Scott Boras now. Surprise, surprise. His father, Kevin, was drafted in 1982 in the 11th round by the Milwaukee Brewers, struggled in rookie ball, and decided he wanted to go back to college, went to Texas A&M to play quarterback. The Brewers and Kevin Murray ended up in court over his $35,000 signing bonus.
Wow.
And so it sounds like Murray went back to Texas A&M, had an ankle injury, damaged his NFL chances.
Mm.
So football's injury, you know, bugaboo.
Yeah, that makes things a little bit more complicated, considering the family history.
The family lineage.
The NFL's so much safer now. Football, nobody gets injured playing football anymore. Come on, Kyler, play football.
So, I mean, this is a kid that's hearing an awful lot of great things about him, rightly and spectacularly, and that's awesome for him. That's a hard thing. I mean, like, to be blessed with that kind of that gift, to be able to do both of these things, and then having important people tell you have to pick one or the other. Bo Jackson said he should pick one.
Oh, really? I wonder if Bo feels that way because he famously got injured. Like, I mean, he had this, like, career-ending hip injury.
It sounded like what Bo was saying was that because everyone is better at sports now than 25 years ago, that I think the implication is, look, the likelihood of being as good as I was at both of these is lower.
Bo just wants that for himself. He's just jealous.
He wants to be the last Bo, yeah.
Can I, just before we move on, just in a completely unrelated Kyler Murray related subject, I just wanted to talk about his tweets for a second. So when he was 14 and 15, he tweeted at his friends using the word queers as an insult, like anti-gay insult. And this is a thing that happens perpetually when someone's in the news, someone looks at the old tweets and finds them. This seems like, obviously, using an anti-gay insult, calling people queers, is like a very bad thing to do, and people shouldn't do it. But to do it at like 14 or 15, just the idea that 14-year-olds are on Twitter is like profoundly sad to me. But it's like not the worst thing that people have found in these like Twitter dredgings that happen. And the thing that frustrates me as a media consumer is that like when ESPN does a story about this, they never actually quote the tweets, just because there's this, I think, whether it's ESPN or New York Times or Washington Post, the more like mainstream outlets, they don't want to include slurs, which, I mean, maybe there's an argument for that. But I feel like it obfuscates, and in a story like this, you actually like need to know what the person said.
What they said.
In order to like evaluate how should I feel about this. And I just, this is just the thing that like recurs every time I'm frustrated, whether it's like Josh Hader or anyone else. You like have to like go to not necessarily like the scammier parts of the internet, but like there's like no there's no mainstream outlet will like tell you actually what the story is about.
Has Murray addressed these at all?
He did. He apologized. He said, "I apologize for the tweets that have come to light tonight. From when I was 14 and 15, I used a poor choice of words that doesn't reflect who I am or what I believe."
So the boilerplate.
The boilerplate.
Yeah, there should be a paragraph in all those stories explaining how the adolescent brain is structured.
Right. And just say what the guy said. Well, we can deal with it, I feel like, as a society. That's all.
One day I want somebody, though, to have like a more forceful renunciation of the stuff they said when they were 15. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, instead of just being like, oh, that's not the way I feel. Like, yo, these were stupid things to say. Like, you know, like this, like.
Well, like, right, like it's like, yo, 15-year-olds.
Absolutely.
Don't do this.
Don't do this, right? Like,
and, I was an idiot.
To actually like say what is wrong with what he said. Like, these are not just a portrait of words. Like, yo, like, you know, this is like, to actually sort of indict or to like, you know, make a criticism of homophobia would be like much more useful than just being like, eh, I was stupid. And it's like, this is a very wishy-washy sort of like wave away. But it would be nice that instead of one of these sort of like, you know, perfunctory apologies or whatever, that someone actually just grapple with the thing they said in a public way. It wouldn't hurt them at all. But also like, it would just be very useful to like underline that why these things are bad.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Before we get to Joel Embiid, Jimmy Butler, and the Philadelphia 76ers, I wanted to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we are going to talk about the Washington football team and its quarterback travails. Mark Sanchez knew the system, maybe a bad system, maybe a bad quarterback. They did not sign Colin Kaepernick, one of several, if not all, NFL teams to have made that decision. To hear that conversation, join Slate Plus for just $35 for the first year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangup+. The Philadelphia 76ers are eight.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Just keep the wooing coming. They're 18-9. They're just 2.5 games behind the Toronto Raptors for first place in the NBA's Eastern Conference. After trading for Jimmy Butler, their core four of Butler, J.J. Redick, Ben Simmons, and Joel Embiid is probably second best behind the Warriors in the whole NBA. And yet, there may be trouble in process dice. on Friday, the Philadelphia Inquirer's Keith Pompey reported, and other people got these quotes too, but I found them in the Inquirer, that Joel Embiid said he hasn't been himself lately. I think it's mainly because of the way I've been used, which is I'm being used as a spacer. I guess a stretch five, which I'm only shooting 29% from three-point range. It seems like the past couple games, with the way I play, Our setup always has me starting on the perimeter, and it just really frustrates me. My body feels great. It's just I haven't been playing well. The thing that I think didn't get enough coverage is that, according to this Inquirer story, and I quote, it didn't help Embiid's mood on Friday that his father, Thomas, is visiting America and was at the arena for the game. So maybe his dad was like, man, son, you got to play better than that. Maybe he was getting some grief from his dad. So the question here is, there are two questions. Number one, is the fact that Jimmy Butler is on the team now and plays a game where he likes to drive to the basket, he wants like a clear lane, is that going to cause problems for the Sixers, who are one of the few teams in the league now that has a true center who can dominate on the block? Is that going to cause long-term problems for this team that is like a legitimate Eastern Conference contender? Number two, is the problem that Jimmy Butler is an asshole and that maybe they're both problems, and that with Chicago and with Minnesota, and maybe we're getting a tiny inkling of it in Philly, that like when Jimmy Butler goes someplace, that people just start getting unhappy.
It's a little column A and a little column B, or a lot of column A and a lot of column B. One is funny that Joel is complaining about being a spacer, because the criticism has always been like, yo, man, stop shooting all these damn threes. Like, he's always hanging out on the perimeter. He is going after Jimmy Butler was like, you know, their big, bold move.
Yeah.
But like you said, like he has, even before the Chicago thing imploded, like the thing there was going to be like, how do you space a team? And that team was built around Rondo, Wade, and Butler, like guys who aren't like knockdown shooters. That was a problem.
That's being very polite.
that was the problem in Minnesota too, where there isn't a ton of shooting on that team, and Wiggins needs the ball. I don't know if he needs the ball. I mean, but
he
wants the ball. I don't know if you should give it to him. And then that team too had a center who was like a really talented multidimensional center in Karl Anthony Towns, who needs space to operate.
Right.
The thing that going after Butler, I mean, there's a bunch of gambles, right? Like, one, he's a couple years – he's older than them. I think he turns 30 this year. So he's like – he changes the sort of window for the Sixers in a lot of ways.
And he's played a huge number of minutes.
Absolutely. It's the Thibodeau thing, right? He's like yeah. – I mean, now they're just like, well, go and play 40 minutes. But that was always going to be an awkward fit. Like, he immediately endeared himself to the Sixers fans because, like, within, like, the first 10 days, he had, like, two ridiculous game-winning shots, yep. right? And so we're like, oh, Jimmy is great. But Jimmy Butler's always, one, been, like, a very productive player and always, like – sort of ruin the games of the players around him. And that is, his contract's up this year. Like, they're going to have to decide in the offseason. And it seems like they're going to throw out a ton of money at Jimmy Butler.
Yeah, you don't make that trade if you're not going to throw money at him just because of what they gave up to get him.
Absolutely. But he's going to be 30. Jimmy Butler is a very good player. Joel Embiid is a generational talent. Like, if Joel Embiid is not happy, like if they're bristling, then like Joel Embiid has to win that argument. Like, the Sixers have to side with Joel Embiid. Like, that, like, I don't know how you navigate that. I mean, because Jimmy Butler is a kind of player that's hard to replace, but Joel Embiid is like, I mean, he's playing at an MVP level. Like, he had a blast. His last 2 weeks have been sort of like meh, but I mean, his numbers are ridiculous. And he's the reason the Sixers are as good as they are. And I think it is hard to replace a Butler, but it's hard to replace a guy like Butler, but it's easier to replace a guy like Butler than it is to find someone like Embiid.
Isn't the issue here that Jimmy Butler played on two non-contending teams
right.
where even with young talent around him that needed some sort of hand-holding, coddling, nurturing, developing, mm-hmm. he was the focus.
Mm-hmm.
He ain't the focus on this
That's
team.
Right.
And shouldn't it be incumbent on Jimmy Butler, who seems like a smart guy and a good human being, like visits kids in the hospital, spends a day with a cancer patient. He seems like a good
guy.
Has an unbelievable life story, yes. It seems like Jimmy Butler is smart enough to recognize that I'm in a situation where we could do some damage in the NBA this year. We have a chance to get to the NBA finals. How do you navigate that as a coach, as a front office, as these two guys who are both – really big talents.
Well, and before we get to that, let's just back up and explain what happened with Minnesota. And he went on strike, essentially, and forced a trade, which is certainly not unprecedented. But the way that he went about it was rather comical. So he was gone for a while. Then he came back at a practice that became instantly legendary.
Legend.
Where he took a team of backups and went against Towns and Wiggins and beat them repeatedly, mm-hmm. and was insulting them, talking about how they're trash. Just
you can't win without me.
And then he immediately went to, Rachel Nichols was like sitting in the stands or like they had a little green room set up, but he immediately went and
sweat dripping.
But
got a Gatorade
in his funny
hand.
Thing about it was like the news about the practice came out and then the interview, it was kind of treated like it was spontaneous, but just the way it was all set up, the whole thing just kind of stunk and was very bizarre. And then he explained the whole thing by just saying, it's because I am competitive. And a lot of athletes say this, that mm-hmm. you can excuse any kind of behavior, whether it's off the court or on the court, because I'm just a competitor and I'm competing and I want to compete. And I'm sure it's true that Jimmy Butler is more competitive than the guys that he was playing with in Chicago and Minnesota, but now we're circling back. Like, how do you deal with a guy who has behaved like a dick and these different markets and says that it's because he's a competitor? Clearly one of the top 20 players in the NBA.
So, but not LeBron and right. not Steph and mm-hmm. not KD. Mm-hmm.
But whose competitiveness, I think, is probably inextricable from his why he's good. Like, so how do you reconcile this as the Sixers?
I mean, it's weird, right? Because, like, the competitive thing is, like, it's part of his, like, this point is, like, it's part of his image. Like, Jimmy Butler just, he's a gamer. He plays really hard.
And his self-mythology.
Absolutely. It's, like, the thing he uh-huh. says about himself. It's almost like the Kobe thing where Kobe just says, like, oh, you know, like, almost like this, like, monomaniacal desire to win. The thing is, Jimmy Butler hasn't won anything, right? Like to justify the level of, like, just, like, animus that he seems to endear with his teammates. Like, if Kobe was, like, famously... I hate Kobe Bryant. Sorry. But Kobe was famously...
You're in a safe space for Kobe.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Kobe was famously a bad teammate, right? And it was always excused by the fact that he, like, had these championship rings, that he won an MVP, yada, yada, yada. But, like, Jimmy Butler hasn't done... I mean, he's an all-star level player. Like you said, he's one of the 20 best players in the league. But it is a lot to, like... I mean, it is a lot to countenance, like, mm-hmm. considering... The returns, like the Sixers, he makes them legitimately a contender, but he's not the best player on the team. And I don't know that, I don't know, like the Sixers have, like part of being the coach of the Sixers for the next 5-6 years is going to be about managing personnel. Even if they hadn't traded for Jimmy Butler, like there's, you know, there's sort of rumblings that Ben Simmons and Embiid sort of are like very different personalities and they're not the, like the closest teammates. And those guys have to get paid. And I mean, like, adding him into this mix was just like this. I mean, it's a huge gamble. I don't know. Like, it is a big part of Jimmy Butler's, like his thing. Like, I mean, and it's like one of the reasons he went from like a fringe player. Like at Marquette, he was a power forward or something like that. Now he's, you know, one of the best wings in the NBA, like with a completely different skill set. He like remade his game. Like that same, motivation and like determination is this thing that cannibalizes like both his ability to be a good teammate. I don't know if you could have Jimmy Butler as like your number two option on a championship level team.
Well, I wonder, you know, you mentioned earlier, Josh, about how we tend to overvalue coaching or overcredit coaching in sports. And this seems to me to be a situation where you'll really find out if mm-hmm. Brown is a good coach of the Philadelphia 76ers.
Yep.
Because there
That's
is,
a good point.
You know, I think Steve Kerr has demonstrated that, you know, not without speed bumps either,
sure, absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
He has demonstrated, and Popovich has done this too, demonstrated an ability to take diverse personalities who have high, high, high skill levels mm-hmm. and somehow come out on the other side with a lot of wins and championships. I don't know that the Sixers are equipped to do that, but we're going to find out how important coaching is here.
Well, this is the modern NBA, right? It's that in order to contend for a title, you need to bring in a certain number of guys, maybe four, who all probably believe that they're the best player on the team
mm-hmm.
or that they should be the best player on the team, and then managing those personalities. And then the other aspect here is that because the Warriors are so good, if you legitimately want to compete with them, then you need to take on enormous risk. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what the Rockets
definitely
did with bringing in Carmelo, which seems like was bad. It was probably a bad idea.
But that was the move when they went for Paul last year. That was the same thinking, right? Like, we need another, like, superstar.
So in order for the Sixers to win a title, unless the Warriors break up, but in order for them to win a title, they probably had to get – they both had to get Jimmy Butler, and that had to work out at, like, the 99th percentile chance of like the best possible scenario had to come through. So you certainly can't blame them for it.
I also don't think that, you know, you can't – Jimmy Butler's going to be Jimmy Butler. Mm-hmm. So Brett Brown is the one, I think, that needs to be watched for how he manages this. Not just the personalities, because you said the personalities, Josh, but also how they play.
Absolutely. I mean, if Markelle Fultz had worked out, this is a different conversation. Like, maybe they don't go after Jimmy Butler. Like, maybe if they see him as, like, if he was showing signs of becoming...
Where are you on Markelle Fultz trutherism?
Oh, man. I feel so... Like, are we at the place where we believe the motorcycle accident? Like, is that where...
I hadn't even heard about a motorcycle accident.
There's this rumor he had some kind of motorcycle accident, and that's what messed up his shoulder. Of course, like... I mean, it's just... At this point, everyone is just like, you know...
We'll find out in, like, 20 years.
Absolutely. Like, after...
30 for 30?
He is either, like, just completely erased from the basketball existence, or he's, like, a Hall of Famer. Like, one of those... Those are the two things that are in play.
Well, he's been diagnosed with thoracic outlet syndrome, and from what I've read on the internet, it's, like, seems real.
Real and not uncommon, mostly with baseball players.
Yeah. I mean,
that's such a way.
We either feel really bad for the guy because he's had this real injury and people have treated him like he's faking it, or that there's just something truly bizarre going on that we won't find out in 20 years.
Even if the injury is real, like the way his team has handled it and the way the Sixers have handled it has been so bizarre, right? I mean, it's been like all this opacity on both sides. Like, who the Sixers said he was clear to play, and then he said he wasn't okay to play. I mean, they kept flipping. Like, it's just, but like, again, you're right. Because of like the Warriors, you just have to take these swings and miss. I mean, like the Raptors did that with Kawhi. Like, you know, they said like we can't. DeMar DeRozan is again like a top 25 dude in the league, and also. Like the distance between Kawhi Leonard and DeMar DeRozan was enough that we have to like blow up our most popular player ever, Vince Carter notwithstanding.
Yeah.
We have to like trade him away to make this move. And you know, Kawhi might not resign, but like that's the kind of move that the Warriors make. That's the kind of position that the Warriors put everyone in. But like just from a basketball standpoint, like Joel Embiid is. There was this really great piece in The Ringer the other day about his numbers on the block, like just how good they are. They called him like Shaquille O'Neal with Olajuwon feet, basically, right? Like, I mean, he just like is this humongous, like strong man who is also really, really agile. A lot of moves in the paint. And his numbers are insane, like on post-ups. I mean, and because he's such a good free throw shooter, like you want to give him as many touches on the post as in the post as possible. Jimmy Butler is the kind of player who... I think we actually are seeing less of. Like, I mean, you think of, like, really good wings in the NBA now, your Kawhis, or even, like, what Wiggins was projected to be. Those guys need to be able to shoot, right? I mean, they need to be able to shoot a lot. I mean, it's one of the things that has, like, held – like, DeMar DeRozan is, like, one of the reasons he's not a top 20 guy.
Yeah.
Is that he is a mid-range guy who's a mid-range guy and a slasher. Like, that – it just gums up the spacing that you need. And the Sixers have – like, spacing has always been a premium for the Sixers because – Ben Simmons never shoots. I mean, he's like a gigantic Rajon Rondo in a lot of ways, right? Like if you have to, it makes you wonder, like, if they kept a guy like Covington who can't put the ball on the floor but can shoot and play D, he's like a elite defender and a good shooter. Is that better than a guy like Jimmy Butler, who is in a vacuum a far superior talent to Robert Covington? Is that better for the Sixers for over the long haul?
We're going to find out in the Eastern Conference. It's like really interesting how so much of the conversation, and rightfully so, has been about how not even top heavy, just like horrible from top to bottom. It's been for almost a generation. And now with Giannis. And the Bucks, and with Kawhi on the Raptors and with
the
Celtics
figures it out,
and the Sixers, it's way, way more interesting than it's been in a very long time. And I think, you know, this is very early days, and Butler is a guy that you definitely want on your team in the playoffs.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be a really, really fascinating Eastern Conference, you know, playoff season this year.
Just to jump on that real quick. I mean, like, last year in the playoffs, you could see watching them in the playoffs, like, they need a Jimmy Butler type of guy who can just, like, go get his own buckets, who can, like, make plays. I mean, the two game winners he hit so far for the Sixers have been, like, just the highest degree of difficulty, right? Like, there's that weird step back 24-footer that he hit over the Nets was like, okay, that is why you brought him here. And that's the kind of shooter, that's the kind of, like, scorer you need in the playoffs. And the Sixers do not have that.
Right.
But I don't know if, you know, getting to the Eastern Conference Finals with Jimmy Butler, adding him and being able to, like, and having your, like, your floor probably being the Eastern Conference Finals is worth, like, potentially, like, alienating Joel Embiid for, you know, who would should be the cornerstone of the franchise for the next 15 years.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The National Football League would like you guys to know that it is so fan-friendly that it wants you, the fan, to help design the next generation of rules. But not silly rules like how and when it's okay to use a hard plastic object strapped to your head to hit another person with a hard plastic object strapped to his head. No, it wants you to help modernize the part of the game that has been revolutionized by Australians. Punting. Josh, the league says the big problem with punts is not that punters are awesome, which they are, or even that it seems too many players get injured on punts, which I don't really think that they do. It's that there are too many penalties, which is a good reason. It's a totally fine reason to change a sport.
There's nothing more frustrating than a penalty on a punt return.
We all agree on that.
Block in the back.
Fans totally agree. I mean, watching that yellow flag play on a punt, oh, terrible. So let's start with, should we start with the ideas about how we can reform punting or whether punting should be reformed? Or should we start with why the NFL is asking fans to help adjudicate its own problems and solve its rules issues?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that this is conflating two completely different issues, the safety issue and the lack of excitement issue. And it's not just conflating two different issues. It's issues that are in direct opposition with each other. So you could reform the punt by, like they did on the kickoffs, like banning wedge busting and all that stuff. Or you could reform it by, doing some various things to make it more exciting. And, you know, there have been like five punt returns for touchdowns this year, like trying to institute rules that would make it harder to cover kicks and would allow for bigger returns. It's just like, I don't understand what the league is trying to do.
I don't know what the problem is, really.
Like, which problem are they trying to solve here?
I think they're mostly picking something that's really low-hanging fruit that they can have a sort of a public relations campaign that includes the idea of safety in air quotes. We are trying to make football safer. Look, we're reforming punting. We reformed the kickoff. But there really isn't a whole lot, I think, to reform here.
How do punters feel about this?
Well, I just asked Chris Cluey, actually, and he responded via email like 5 minutes ago. Cluey said, I honestly don't think punting needs to be changed. The danger of kickoffs is that you have guys starting at opposite ends of the field and running at each other, whereas punts start with guys lined up at the line of scrimmage and then running with each other. So the danger of those massive collisions is very unlikely, except for the returner, and that happens super rarely. Just about the only thing I can think of to make it safer, we're moving into Chris Cluey territory here, than a normal football play would be to have the players wear those inflatable sumo suits. That would be entertaining. The punter, however, would be at a great disadvantage if he had to wear the inflatable sumo suit.
And the returner, right? I mean, the returner would be...
fun to watch him.
You know, to listeners, Gene was kind of wobbling around in his seat like an inflatable sumo guy. But the reforms that have come into place for kickoffs have been to make them more punt-like. Mm-hmm. And not allowing players to run up. You have to just stand on the line of scrimmage mm-hmm. before the kick, moving the...
Let's try to slow it down a little.
Yeah.
And minimize the number of returns, which is much harder to do with the punt.
Sure. So the MMQB had a bunch of their writers come up with suggestions for how to reform the punt. The ones that I liked were banning punts entirely. That's worth us discussing at some point.
Chris Cluey would not like that one. Mm-hmm.
Number two, this was from Connor Orr. This is actually genius. Make it so a team cannot have the same person punt more than once a game.
Oh, wow.
Also would not be good for the Chris Cluey's of the world, but would be very entertaining.
It actually could be very good because you have six punters on your roster.
That's true.
I'm sure that's how it would shake out.
Totally.
Exactly. the other rule that I think would be very interesting would be that you are not allowed to punt from the opponent's side of the field.
I thought that was really, really interesting, really intriguing.
So the obvious negative on that was that it would create a perverse incentive where when you're holding onto a lead late in a game, you would get teams running backwards mm-hmm. to go from the opponent's 45 to their own. I mean, if you love delay of game penalties.
Mm-hmm. You could waive the rule in the last 2 minutes.
Right. Maybe
or something like that.
The solution to changing the rules is to make the rule even more complicated. I like it. I like where your head's at.
But then maybe there's a premium on big leg kickers, right? So if you're at the 45, right, that's too short a field to punt. Mm-hmm. But maybe if you have a big leg kicker, you could just take a swing at a field goal, if you're in the opponent's half of the field.
More long field goals. Stefan is going to sign on to that.
I would do everything to incentivize more long field goals. Yeah. I mean, and one way to incentivize more long field goal is to, again, waive another rule where the ball has to be at the line of scrimmage. If you miss the field goal, you could, again, push it back to the 30. Make it standard.
Right, right. That's right.
So, I mean, there are ways to deal with that, too. I thought that Andy Benoit's suggestion that making the punt dead at the point where the ball touches the ground is interesting. I mean, it would reduce the number of returns potentially, but it would encourage punters to just go for it, to really swing for it and not be quite as strategic.
That is what the NFL is looking for, just ways to make punters look more cool. Is that that's
totally
your supposition here?
Yeah.
So the one thing I don't want to get rid of is one of my favorite plays in football, which is when the punt is rolling and then it stops at the one. Mm-hmm. My favorite part of that is the guys who are just standing around the ball, wait for it to stop rolling, then touch it and then start celebrating as if they did something.
I also like it when the guys try to avoid going into the end zone.
That is a cool,
that is legit cool. Yeah. To avoid the touchback on a punt.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you're punting on the 45, on the opponent's 45, right?
Yeah.
You have this tiny, tiny field. You're trying to, I mean, I guess this is more your world than any of ours, but you're trying to nail it in the corner, at the one or the two, right? I mean,
sure.
That's really hard, right?
And then it is really hard, but the introduction of these Australian kickers
one in every five Australian can do that with great proficiency.
Well, I think the Australians aren't they raised from a very young age?
Yeah. And they can put the reverse spin on the ball and they can do weird trickery.
I mean, the weird thing is that punting actually has been legit revolutionized in the last 5 years. It is one aspect of professional football that has really changed because of the introduction of new techniques and new athletes. So I really think that, this is the NFL trying to gin up some publicity on a very safe way.
If they wanted to gin up publicity, wouldn't they do it with something other than punting?
I don't know. It's probably, this is...
punting.
I'm looking at
their announcement. They want ideas for punting. I'm so excited about giving ideas for punting.
Their announcement? This is part of their data analytics competition in its first and future program.
Oh, my God.
Designed to spur innovation in athlete safety and performance.
Yeah, I guess punting is like, you know, the NFL is trying to like, you know, tinker at the margins a little bit, right? So like, not that, no offense to the punter, so I just call it marginal.
No. Punters but, are marginal. They understand that. That's part of their job.
So, okay, so let's go back to this. One person can only punt once a game. If you had a terrible offense, like if you knew that you did not have like skill position players, like it was going to be a bunch of three and outs all season, what percentage of your personnel is punters, or can like sub in as a punter? Like, do you have receivers who can like reasonably kick?
In my experience, most quarterbacks, a lot of quarterbacks punted in high school,
mm-hmm.
just sort of.
Best athlete on
best
the team, sort
on
of
the
deal.
Team coordinated.
Need like a Randall Cunningham type who was like a an All American as a punter.
All right, we're all agreed punts instead of kickoffs in 2019. And on that note,
so moved,
Gene. Now that we've saved the NFL, I think we can say that your work is done for today.
And save the Sixers.
Save the Sixers
too.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it. This was fun.
Great to have you as always. Thank you.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Stefan, now it is time for Afterballs. And the guy from Australia who's played the most games in the NFL is a fellow by the name of LaDainian Tomlinson. Darren Bennett, punter, shocker. What do we know about Darren Bennett?
Big Aussie rules football player before he came to the NFL in 1994, 6'5". Who could forget?
He made punting cool. We're just going to go. I don't know if it's true.
Kids, that's when kids really all said, I want to be a punter. It was because of Darren Bennett. He was like the all-decade team in the 90s for the NFL. A couple of Pro Bowls, kicked the ball far, a lot of yards. Revolutionized the game, introduced the drop punt to the NFL.
Darren Bennett, a name that will never be forgotten. Maybe. Stefan, what is your Darren Bennett?
Well, back in August, I talked about my visit to Cooperstown, and I mentioned that the museum's curator, Tom Scheiber, had given me a tour of the Hall of Fame's permanent collection, and that it was really cool. What I didn't mention was that Scheiber located for me in the basement library my solitary contribution to the largest collection of baseball books on the planet. Of course, I took some pictures of Wild and Outside in the Hall of Fame. There are pictures of me pointing at the book on the shelf. And I happened to be looking at them the other day. There are three copies on the left edge of a top shelf, each with a sticker on the spine with the book's Library of Congress classification number. And I noticed for the first time that my book about the Independent Northern League is next to books about the Oakland Athletics. Because Scheiber told me this morning, Northern League comes alphabetically before Oakland Athletics. The shelf to my left is jammed with books about New York baseball teams. In any case, three books down from Wild and Outside is Champagne and Baloney, The Rise and Fall of Finley's A's by Tom Clark, which was published in 1976. I'd never heard of Champagne and Baloney, but what a great title. I'd also never heard of Tom Clark, but that just marks me as a literary lightweight. Clark, I discovered, published about 50 books, including 30 volumes of poetry and biographies of Jack Kerouac and Damon Runyon, among others. In the 1960s, Clark hitchhiked in England with Allen Ginsberg, and at the age of 22 was the poetry editor of the Paris Review. But he was also a baseball fanatic. One of the poetry books, Fan Poems, is mostly about baseball. Clark wrote an as-told-to autobiography of the pitcher Mark Fidrich of the Tigers after his shooting star rookie season in 1976. And he also published a book of prints of portraits of players that Clark himself painted, accompanied by text that he pieced together from interviews and articles that humanizes the athletes. But Champagne and Baloney is Clark's big nonfiction baseball work. It's a 432-page book about Charlie Finley, the iconoclastic, egomaniacal, and universally hated owner of the A's, who dressed his team in garish green and gold, endorsed orange baseballs and bases, introduced Hot Pants Day at the stadium, pushed for night World Series games and the designated hitter, and through his penury, helped usher in free agency. According to a review in the New York Times, Champagne and Baloney doesn't offer behind-the-scenes insight into Finley's then 15 chaotic years as owner of the A's, but is an entertaining and enthusiastic literary fan's notes. The Times reviewer Christopher Lehman Haupt quoted some of Clark's prose. A's third baseman Sal Bando romps around the bases like a mustachioed springbok. Catcher first baseman Gene Tennis's double play pivot has all the grace of a wounded buffalo's dying fall. Charlie Finley, like kings and great entertainers, is more than just a person. He's an experiential gestalt. Clark grew up in Chicago. His father took him to games at Comiskey, and he worked as an usher at Wrigley. Clark once wrote that baseball opened up a secret door in the wall to numinous worlds religion promised but never delivered. And he said that poetry and baseball, quote, have a natural relationship. The best poems and the best baseball games share a dramatic tension you can't find in very many other places. It's no surprise that his mentor at the University of Michigan was the United States Poet Laureate Donald Hall, who wrote a biography of Doc Ellis and essays and poems about baseball. Clark's book about baseball poetry, which was also published in 1976, very busy year for him, includes poems about Catfish Hunter, Bill Lee, and other legends of the era. So long, Roberto Clemente, you have joined the immortals who've been body snatched by the Bermuda Triangle, Clark wrote in The Great One. When your plane went down, it forced tears out of grown men all over the hemisphere. Al Oliver and even Willie Stargell cried. The poem ends, I just hope those Martians realize they are claiming the rights to far and away the greatest right fielder of all time. And here's Clark's most famous poem about the game, Baseball and Classicism. Every day I peruse the box scores for hours. Sometimes I wonder why I do it, since I am not going to take a test on it, and no one is going to give me money. The pleasure is something like that of codes, of deciphering an ancient alphabet, say, so as brightly to picturize Eurydice in the Elysian fields on her perfect day, the day she went 5-for-5 against Vic Rashi. Tom Clark died, I learned, 8 days after I visited Cooperstown. He was 77 years old and was hit by a car in his hometown, Berkeley, California. I am honored that my book stands just a few spots away from his in the Hall of Fame. Josh, what's your Darren Bennett?
As a Levine, I was not ever expecting that there would be an NBA player whose own last name sounds the same as mine. Which brings us to Zach Levine of the Chicago Bulls, L.A., capital V, I-N-E, who is definitely not the worst player to share a name with. He won the slam dunk contest twice, including in maybe the best modern contest, like post-MJ Dominique contest, his duel against Aaron Gordon in 2016. He tore his ACL in February 2017, but he's come back. He appears to be in good health. He got traded from the Wolves to the Bulls in the Jimmy Butler trade, or I should say a Jimmy Butler trade. On October 26th of this year, I texted a friend to say, did not realize that Zach LaVine is now the best player in the NBA. I included a link to Zach Lowe's 10 Things I Like column for that week, in which he noted that this being very early in the NBA season, Zach LaVine was averaging 32 points a game on 57% shooting. According to Zach Lowe, he was attacking the rim with a new ferocity. He was making 67% of his attempts on drives, which was a very high mark for the league. He's getting to the free throw line 9 times. Zach LaVine is like hitting his stride. So fast forward to present day. He is now averaging fewer points, 24 points. He's down to 44% shooting from the field, 31% from three. His team is 6-21. And then on the Zach Lowe podcast with Kevin Arnovitz a couple of weeks ago, love Zach Lowe, love Kevin Arnovitz. Let's listen to how they discussed Zach LaVine. Let's fire up the first clip from this podcast.
What's interesting about the Bulls?
I mean,
other than Zach LaVine is now shooting 30% from three and 43% overall.
You know what? Yes, Zach LaVine.
Just the disdain with which Kevin Arnovitz says Zach LaVine. It's just cut me to my core. Let's resume their conversation with the disdainful Zach LaVine. Why the disdain, Kevin?
Yes, Zach LaVine, let me come down the floor, post up Bryn Forbes from 20 feet, get to 18 feet, and launch a turnaround jump.
Wow, I did not expect this, Kevin Arnovitz.
There's not one survey of the floor, not one inkling that a basketball possession is full of cool possibilities, that there are three guys standing behind the arc with a Spurs defense that's sort of playing middle, and if not packed, certainly playing off the perimeter. You know, and it's just like the ball hoggery right now, especially when you factor in Jabari, is just tough to watch.
So when you think of the name LaVine, think of ball hoggery that's tough to watch, and think of a disdain for the idea that a basketball possession could be magic. That's what the name LaVine stands for now. Let's listen to another clip. There's more. We'll play one more clip about Zach LaVine.
What is Zach LaVine going to decide whether he wants to play a functional brand of defense as a player in the NBA?
See, actually,
all these theories. His athleticism is vertical. It's not lateral. Like, whatever.
Wow.
Kevin Arnovitz.
We like Kevin Arnovitz.
Not a guy who's like, he's not somebody who you can annoy very easily, very even keel. He starts with Zach LaVine and ends minutes later with whatever. So, Zach, we need to talk, my friend. You've got to try to play some defense. Get that three-point percentage up a little bit. We want you to understand that there are magical possibilities in a basketball possession, and that passing the ball is not optional. It's ideal. So LaVine maybe can stand for something better and greater than it is today. I'm just glad to have an NBA player with my name. Though.
Can I just say, when you said Zach Lowe, I thought you were, that was like his nickname.
That is not. No, that's a different guy. Zach LaVine, his nickname is Zach LaVine, I think, at this point. That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup, and you can email us at hangup@slate.com. Call-in show. Call us, please. 77-HANGUP-10. We'd love to hear from you. For Stefan Fatsis, Josh LaVine, members Elmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.